You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello and welcome to Future Friday. It is I, your host, Tom May. As always, if you want to reach out to me, please email me, tom@futurefriday.net. I'll get back to you. Today, I am joined by the legendary Scott Bell. Scott has been the tour manager of the Menzingers for over a decade. He has charged headfirst into every hailstorm. He has shepherded us and held our hands up every valley and down every peak on this incredible journey. When he is not liberating brats on the Eastern Front or waging rider war on the West, he is a fierce history buff, a relentless and inspiring political organizer, and a scene maker in Michigan, curating shows and festivals and providing a platform for artists and punters alike as a promoter. He is one of my best friends in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, the first of many recorded conversations with Scott Bell. I'm just going to start getting this recording.
Oh, yeah.
There
we go.
Scott, thank you so much for joining me. I already did an intro. Well, I'm going to do an intro, and you will have already heard it, but this is Scott Bell, our tour manager.
Hey.
I would call you a political agent. I would say a promoter extraordinaire and all around beautiful and interesting human being. I was hoping that we could start off with one of my favorite parts about you, or one of the Scott trivia facets. Tell us about your first couple jobs.
Okay, so my first job that I was ever paid for was I was a mascot at a local grocery store, like cereal mascots. Like I've been Count Chocula. I've been every cereal character in a blow-up costume. I've been Captain Crunch. I've been Count Chocula. Kool-Aid Man, right? Chester Cheeto. I've been a Twinkie, all of them. And it was great. I mean, you sweat a lot and you scare kids. And I want to think it was my friend Zach's mom was the deli director, and she got us the job, and she was like, we'll pay you guys like $8 an hour. And we were like, my God, we don't have to work the rest of the summer if we just walk around the zoo during the free zoo day and scare kids. And, you know, I mean, some kids like you, and that's pretty heartwarming, you know, but you just kind of, you dance and stuff. And then after that, I got a job working at Flying J Truck Stop, had just opened. I was the buffet kid. My job was to guard the meat and like slice the meat as thin for the corporate overlords, but like thick for like the Teamster truckers, you know, it was constant. And I also had to like squeeze the rolls. And if they were like old, I had to throw them away. And that was the test. They're like,
what a wildly like pseudo-sexual activity for a teenager. You have to squeeze the rules. That's funny. I wonder if this battle between the thickness of the meat slicing is an allegory or at least a preparation for your later career aspirations in politics. Maybe not necessarily career aspirations, but just activism aspirations.
Passion. Provocateur.
You're trying to consolidate and or at least reconcile the corporate need or whatever, the higher need with the Teamsters need. You can't get fired.
Yeah. You know? That was the first, it was also the first job where I first came into contact with like conspiracy theory, Illuminati stuff. This was 2005, 2004.
And right at the kickoff of that job.
Oh, yeah. Well, and this trucker handed me, he handed me this VHS tape and he was like, let's watch this when you have some free time. And it was like the most overdubbed, grainy video about the Illuminati and the New World Order, and then all this like weird Jewish stuff. And that was when I kind of realized like this guy's crazy. He's like, he's a regular at a truck stop.
Yeah. And yeah, for that's, you know, there's so much there. I, as you know, and many people know, I've been into conspiracy theory culture for a very long time, both for what I find immensely entertaining and also for some things that I think that need to be very seriously re-looked at. But I've been exposed to all of those things in the deepest, darkest places you can imagine. 2020 was a very, very, very bad year because it went mainstream. So you have all these fucking middle-aged people from Facebook piling into places that were once fun refuge for doing like alternative research, and now you have these people like selling crystals and acting like psychopaths and then storming the Capitol because they took literally something that is completely baseless. We could dive into that. But it's so funny to think that that's rap, Flying J culture wrapped up. We spent so much time on tour living at truck stops, coming in and out of these places, and they are islands of like a bizarre travel culture. You watch Lord of the Rings, or you picture Western movies back in the day, or old pirate stuff, or even like Silk Road shit. You'd feel like you'd be staying at an inn and meeting all the travelers there. But no, the American version is a Flying J, where you have a buffet, right?
I mean, yeah, you're excited. You're excited that there's like bananas.
Yeah,
that like
exactly.
that the trader before you brought fresh fruits from the from South America. And you're like, wow, I don't have to eat the roller hot dog right now,
Yeah, which was the early part. You first eat the roller hot dog and then learn that
that's
very bad.
It's I remember being like, it's better to be hungry right now than just get the corn nuts and keep it moving than try to make whatever's happening here a meal.
Hell yeah. So, not going to get into where we met just yet, but you played in a band called the Cartridge Family.
Yeah.
Great name. This is how we met you guys that way. We met you that way.
Yep.
But I wonder if there isn't a direct connection between the antics of the serial monster cosplay into Cartridge Family theatrics.
Yeah. So
if anybody lives in Philly, this is like the Bad Luck 13 of Lansing. This is like there's some tree fort elements here if you're from the Southeast. It was a very punk rock band in all of the senses.
Too much Wu-Tang Clan worship and too much like Gorilla Biscuits etiquette and too much Murder City Devils influence. Me and a group, the band was a real band, infamous concert poster artist Craig Horky started it, played guitar, and also breathed fire in the band. My group of friends post high school kind of joined them. We all moved into everyone's, they were the renters. They lived in houses and we lived in the basements and of these punk houses, and we joined the band. And we just, I was the second lead singer. And eventually, we had like, we'll just put another guitar on stage. And then it was like, put another drummer on stage, Oh, here, you want this floor tom? Oh, here, let's. And then we started to branch out into themed shows. It was very, we had a member who ran for mayor one year out of boredom. So we got, but we got on the ballot. So we were allowed to be in the 4th of July parade. So we got a trailer, a flatbed trailer, and we played on it. Everyone, you dress up, you wear as much spandex as possible, different and the different costumes.
Our paths collided when we were touring on our way down to Fest at a punk house in Savannah, Georgia, where no one was wearing shoes and they were feeding a spider on the front porch that became very large. We played with, I believe, you guys and
Slingshot Dakota,
that was it. And a night where Greg and I slept on the floor where they put a bucket over dog shit. And I'm also convinced that the house or the people in the house were haunted because I had sleep paralysis for one of only two times in my life. And there were definitely demons clawing at me in my sleep. But yes, we met at that house. It was a super weird, experience. And you guys then rented a flatbed trailer and drove around Fest in Gainesville, Florida, just playing on it. And I remember someone fell off and got a concussion. Was it Craig?
Yeah. My buddy, my friend Zach, actually, who got in the or maybe it was Craig. A lot of concussions in this pit. We weren't right wing. We weren't left wing. We were fight for your right wing was the mantra,
There's so many facets. So you guys are a bunch of basement punk house dwelling people who just started a band, put as many people as you can, but you also had an ambition and an organization, like an organizational drive to be able to pull off some of the things. You're talking about somebody running for mayor. You're talking about renting moon bounce houses and bringing them to shows.
Yep.
There's stories of, we rented a flatbed trailer. There's so many facets of this. What about the Chinese Buffet Liberation Army, where if you consume enough, it drives down the cost of the all-you-can-eat down to zero or below, where it starts to cost them? All of these things are just fucking amazing.
Yeah.
The BLC.
The Buffet Liberation Corps. That was a big, because like theoretically, you eventually can cost them money. And you're rolling with 15 immature 20-something guys and gals, you know, ever, you know, if you had a significant other, they were immediately in the band. I mean, the first thing they told me was like, if you come on this tour with us, you're going to lose your job and you're going to lose and your girlfriend's going to break up with you. And those, both of those things happened like a week in, like mostly because I forgot to call off my dishwashing job.
Yeah, that'll happen.
At Flying J, I've like had to move to back and forth to the dish tank, and they're like, "What do you mean you're not in Pittsburgh?" And I was like, "Punk rock, we got to do this show," and I was also an idiot. So, but yeah, I mean, we ran a record label, you know the book Our Band Could Be Your Life, you know, about the early '80s DIY scene, was the Bible, you know.
And yeah, just totally,
let's put out our own records, let's book our own shows, let's book our own tours, let's host. And you know, Fest, like you talk about Fest in Gainesville, was a huge part of that like cohesion of, you know, how I met you guys. And like,
yeah, it was like, I always described it as what it was like, a punk rock conference to an extent, because it was everybody coming down and mostly just hanging out. Everyone who went was in a band, whether they were in a band at home or not, you know. So kind of became a place to network and figure out how to do more touring.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And it was like, hey, well, like I have this, you know, I have this dive bar and these like house venues that we can, you can come play up in Lansing, Michigan, you know, ever heard of it? Let's have a show.
Yeah. And so that was exactly what you did for us. Then we ended up in Lansing. This is probably, I'm just going to say it's 2009. It's just my guess.
Yeah.
So we come up and play in Lansing. Yeah. You set up the show at Max Bar. The show gets canceled. I forget exactly why, but then you moved us to your living room where we built a mic stand by out of a, I think we used a road cone and a broom handle. Mm-hmm. And we took a 20-ounce bottle of soda, cut the bottom off and stuck the microphone in that. And then Greg and I shared that mic while we played in your guys' living room while Craig was living in the basement. And it was an incredible time. Never forgot it. We actually, funnily, hilariously enough, Greg was friends with someone who was on the, you know, the AAA sports team. It was either, I think it was gymnastics, maybe?
Yeah, it was Michigan State Gymnastics. Yeah.
Michigan State Gymnastics. So we ended up over there at a dorm room party with all of the Michigan State gymnast team and their, like, you know, athletic boyfriends. And that was, there was just a hilarious experience all around. But we became very close friends, and then mm-hmm. you started a tour with us after that. But to rewind it before that, you're doing this stuff with the Cartridge Family. You start to book a lot of shows that are, you know, like we read this book, This Band Could Be Your Life. You start to realize that you can just take things into your own control, and there's not really rules for anything. The stereotypical notion that some guy with a cigar is visiting his daughter at college and goes to an open mic and sees the guy playing, that just doesn't really happen.
No.
Everybody has to make their own way, and you guys literally made your own way in a hilarious way. So now this rolls out into you becoming, you know, a very serious promoter, and now grown to be, I mean, I would imagine the largest or one of the largest promoters in your region of Michigan, which rolls down into Detroit. So did you think you learned a lot from the Cartridge Family DIY joke experiences into turning it into a real career?
Oh, totally. I mean, you go from being kicked out of venues and like the owner threatening to like, you know, you have to pay for the light you damaged, and then you just kind of balk at that until he says, "Well, you got to throw my staff a pizza party," and you're like, "Well," and then you learn that like the owner of this business that you think is a millionaire is like actually like has no idea what they're doing either. So like, oh, if we just con him into giving us 5 to 9 p.m. all ages, like we know. Like, I know the Gaslight Anthem. I know 100 people will show up to the Gaslight Anthem. I know 100 people will come to see the Red Scare Tour with, like, the Menzingers and Cobra Skulls. Like, and we're the only ones who think that. So let's do that. And then, oh my gosh, there's money left over. Cool. Now we can, like, press the next, you know, we can put out the Cheap Girls record, or we can put out, you know, any number of local things and just kind of keep that rolling. And then before you know it, you have, like, kind of have this like scene, and you've learned to like, you know, how to promote a show, and then you're like, wow, that's actually a job, you know, this. And then building
totally.
I'm big into like the movement being sustainable, you know, like constant, yeah. Especially in a college town where like things turn over every 2, 3, 4 years as kids move on, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, and I think that's one thing that people may find surprising who aren't in quote unquote the know of the situation. And that is that oftentimes when we were coming up, especially the places that we would be the most popular at and do the most well at were centralized around either a local one local band or a couple of individuals that created a scene in a perfect storm at a place like you're mentioning. You went to the bar. You say, I have, you know, give me 4 hours all ages at this time, and I know these bands that will come here, and this many people will come see them. And all it takes is those small individual actions that created those scenes for us when we were coming through. We grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and there was a place called you know, we tried to do that somewhat in Scranton. We had a couple venues. I went and started – I talked to an owner of a skate park into letting us book shows there. And then that became – next thing you know, there was 500 people at the shows. And then it got robbed and everything came crashing down and skinheads and cliques and hardcore gangs were beating shit out of each other and it all had to end. But that's what we did. And in Wilkes-Barre, there was one place that a Cafe Metropolis and Homebase that were just scenes that the whole if you build it, they will come thing from fucking Field of Dreams became a reality. And there are many places around the country that ended up being like that for us. You know, everywhere from Normal, Illinois at the Firehouse with Zach to... you know, place it to places in upstate New York, like the Bug Jar. It just really kind of manifested itself, and it's super interesting how that works. And I think that there's a switch in a lot of our minds that realize that you can come to the realization that, no, I am in control of these situations.
Yeah, especially as a kid, like, oh, like, are you have something to give, you know? I constantly tell younger bands and artists and, like, rappers and DJs, like, this is how much you – it's whatever you make of it, man. Like, whoever's going to – and so, partly it's like – it's either like tempering expectations or like or trying to get or trying to like gas people up. It's like so often like young bands are like, oh, like no one's gonna come see us, and I'm like, well, you got 20 friends, let's find three other bands that have 20 friends. Now you have a show, and if you actually like hang out and like that's a scene, that's a simple, you know, especially in like a smaller town like this, you know.
Yeah.
Just in general, and like, and be fair, like my operate, like what we do is like super small fish compared to like large concerts, but like that's sure. It's easy, it's as simple as that. You never know what's going to come out of that.
Yeah, and kind of reframing essentially what it is kind of helps, and that is that it's a party. Like if you, when we were starting, our friends would come see us. We actually talked recently a lot about how a lot of the first places that we went to became popular, besides being, you know, the largest cities in the country and cultural hubs of the world, you know, like New York and Chicago and shit like that, was because groups of people from Scranton that we knew lived there, and they'd be like, hey, I moved to this town. I'm from Scranton. I have like 15 friends here that are my work colleagues and shit. We're all coming to the show because it's going to be awesome. It's like it's a party, essentially. So instead of getting, you know, drunk in someone's garage or whatever, you could go to a place with a purpose to see bands and have fun and meet people and stuff. And I think that is a great way to look at it.
Yeah.
Without sounding like assholes, where do you think it's going to go after the pandemic? There's so much to pack into after we are vaccinated and it's safe to be in public again. But I really think that, I really hope that there's going to be a snap. The rubber band's going to fling so far in the other direction that people are going to go to tons of shows. And it's going to be like the Roaring Twenties post the 1918 so-called Spanish flu again.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely answered it. And you also prefaced it because I've been asked this question by all kinds of local yokel like news stations and radio when they do the interview with the like music guy that will actually answer questions. And like, I always preface it with like, well, I'm not a scientist, so it's not up to me when it's like safe. And, but I mean, yeah, I mean, the Roaring Twenties, man, it's going to happen. Like people are going to be, very pent up, and like festivals are going to be a new thing. And there's going to be so much pent up. You only live once. Attitude, yeah. Especially with art and culture, if we, as long as we can, we, it doesn't get any worse, and we can come out of this with like healthy art scenes and cultures, and you know, that's why saving independent small venues, right? And you know, there's obviously, I think there needs to be some support for actual artists who create and fill the space, you know, without digging into like those kind of like logistics. I totally think you'll see a change in like, I mean, how you treat artists, how the fan appreciates artists, right? You know, like how many times you see our scene say things like, you know, when we come back, we're all buying tickets, no more guest list, right? Like, which is something I like deal with on a day-to-day basis. And obviously like, that's just a thing. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, it's not that much money to you or them comparatively, but like, that's a good mantra to like, think about. Like, I'm going to support everybody, right? Like,
Totally.
We're going to everything, and like maybe we'll be more open to new types of expression and bands, art, you know. I mean, it's all rock and roll.
I fucking hope so. Exactly. And it's really easy for me to talk about this 10 years on from a nice place, being 34 years old now, or I guess more than 10 years on. But in 2008, 2009, 2010, that was a financial collapse. And that also created a unique time for artists. And it was one that made us. So the fact that we couldn't play in bars and standard venues because they were closed, nothing like it is now. So not even close to like it is now. But it was still unable to afford to go to a place where people had to buy drinks and expensive tickets. So it created the house show scene that really exploded in a lot of the, especially East Coast places. And on the West Coast, there's a lot of non-traditional venues, and there always will be. But that scene made our band. That allowed us to be able to play shows that didn't cost money for anyone, but allowed a lot of people to get into our music and like our band. And then they rooted for us. So like you're saying, the support that everybody has now, where the idea is, fuck the guest list, you know, you can pay to go to the show. People want to root for those that are downtrodden. And it is funny, you know, that the artists are the last. And that kind of makes sense in a way, because it's intangible the way that it's set up in our current, you know, like economic reward system. It's not tangible. You can listen to us, especially now that you can just listen to a song for free, and you should be able to listen to a song for free, in my opinion. This is not, it does not require any energy to get from point A to point B. It's a series of ones and zeros. It's negligible. But yeah, we'll see if there's any mirrors that had happened in 2008 to 2010 to after this.
Yeah. I remember thinking once, you know, a couple of years ago, like, oh, wow, like, you didn't think anything of it because we were just broke. Like, oh, wow, that was a recession. That was a shitty time for like everything. Like, my state's largest employer did almost completely go belly up. Like, we almost stopped making cars. Like, oh, like, that does a lot to the tax base. And like, that means kids, even, you know, people don't give up entertainment as quickly as they give up other things in a recession. But like, all our shows were $10 when everywhere else could afford 20, you know?
Exactly.
And this, you know, so going back, like, yeah, what is the mindset of like people half our age creating art going to be, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Fucking nuts. So one of my favorite things about you and being your friend is, while we're on tour, having a shared interest in history. And especially having a shared interest in the history of where we are while we're on tour, and taking advantage of those things. There has been more times than I can remember where you have woken people up early and dragged them to various historical and beautiful places that we normally would be too cynical, jaded, or hungover to go and experience. So that, where does that come from? Have you always had a huge interest in history? Or is it like, can you pinpoint the budding of it?
Yeah, I mean, my fiance Laura says I'm very like receptive to everything, or like I pay attention. I think it's the like opposite, in like an ADHD way, but like where I'm paying, like I'm seeing everything, so I'm not paying attention to anything. So, you know, yeah. But like when you're in, and also I didn't do any traveling as a kid, right? Growing up, I lived in it's a fairly boring, normal Midwest town. So being
sure, I would say fair enough. We were very jaded over, or sorry, very, you know, lucky over here, because you'd go on a field trip to New York City on a school bus and you'd get back before school was over.
You know? Right. I mean, and that just didn't exist. So like being anywhere is like, you know, there was a time, yeah, when making it to California like really meant something, and like soaking up people's way of lives and like culture and like, you know, like I just listened to your interview with Kaylee Goldsworthy, and like you talk about going to different countries, especially South America and Australia, where you just hear like the birds sound differently, and like the trees are still trees, but they're like different species, and how that like how then seeing that through like, oh, what does a local think of that? That's their day to day. Like, that's fascinating, right? And trying to soak up as much of that as possible, because a lot of these places we won't ever go again, you know?
It's true.
Especially in the early days when you're like, well, this could all end tomorrow. And like, and then, you know, you go to Europe a couple of times, you're like, okay, maybe, maybe I will,
still recording,
you know,
so we can fix it.
Maybe I will go back to London. You know?
Hell yeah. Sorry, I just had a little glitch. I'll have to pull that out in the editing there, or just leave it in here awkwardly. But so you have a fantastic ability to contextualize to historical things. So I think that's the biggest key to learning anything, history or not.
I'm going to Google contextualize really quick, Tom, and just get back.
Oh, sure.
Get back to you. Okay. Yeah, you know what? Maybe I do. Okay, yeah. Spot on. Well said, Tom.
Hell yeah, thank you. We had a technical issue. I'm going to have to get on the robotic chat for 45 minutes to talk to the company about what happened.
Skynet's making its first moves.
Skynet, can you imagine live on a podcast, Skynet's just making its
first that came for the podcasters.
Of course. All right, so what we're diving into is your ability to contextualize historical situations and events to why we're there and what's going on. It's super fascinating, and I was wondering what you find fascinating about it. Like, why do these historical stories play such an important narrative in your vision of the present?
I mean, like, especially going around the U.S., like, because America is such a, it's a concept, you know? Like,
yeah.
You go to Poland and you're just like, well, there's always been Polish people here, so that's why it's Poland, right? Or you go to Italy and they're like, we've always been, you know, we've been Roman. We've been roaming around this peninsula for a long time, and here we, you know. But you know, especially America, like, why did these people end up here, you know? Like, how did, just like, and how do you, and like, where do you go from there? You know, what's your future look like? You know, these people at one point in time in Ohio, you know, thought that, you know, Ohio was the California of America. All the dreams and free thinkers went to Ohio. Imagine that today, you know? And of course, like, it's much more exotic when you're in Europe and you're like, oh, you know, why is Ireland two countries right now, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, like, what was our first trip to Dublin? We went and we were playing a show. Show sold out in some bar, and it also happened to be the Super Bowl for the Irish sport of hurling, right? Gaelic leagues. And like, I think you said, like, I spent my entire childhood growing up in America, and like, I had no, I'm paraphrasing it, but you're like, I had no idea. Like, 80,000 people are going to this game, and I've never heard of this sport before in my life. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Like, how.
They all speak English.
And they all speak English. And there's no, yeah. You're just like, why? What are the reasons for that? Right.
Love that. It is a great point to bring up the regional intricacies and differences in the United States are so much more bizarre. So the things in Europe make so much sense, where you have someone who lived there or a culture that was molded for a couple thousand years. Whereas in the United States, there's so much, it was done in the last couple hundred years, and specifically the last even 60 to 100 years, especially on the West Coast. So you have the tragic violence of the destruction and dehumanization of Aboriginal people and Native people that lived here. And you can still see a lot of remnants of that in the on the West Coast, where you run-ins with people who really look of Native American descent. If you're not, you know, are normally the first people you encounter look impoverished and look like, you see people working at a Walmart and shit like that. And you're like, fuck, this is a real thing. You know, we drove all of these different people away, and the Europeans did this in a very short period of time. But even beyond that, there's the weird industries that may pop up in an area and draws a certain ethnic group there. So you'll see that the corner stores are Polish or whatever. Like, there's just so much intense difference even from a couple miles away that it becomes just so fascinating. And the more you learn about it, the more you realize that it all kind of connects together. I feel like that's one search in life, is to find that unifying, those unifying ideas and why they are, like, just putting context onto it. Even right now, I think you're wearing a t-shirt from the Museum of the American Revolution. Yeah, there it is, in Philadelphia, which is a great museum. I highly recommend anybody wanting to who comes to Philadelphia to go check it out. It's really new. My fiance actually worked on the marketing team when it first came out, and there was like a bunch of cool kind of things that they did there.
Yeah, it's a good one. It highlights the struggle of like what is, like, how there were so many revolutions going on within one. You know, it wasn't just what Ben Franklin thought. Like, the Native Americans had their own, like, battles and tribulations, and like, women had
killed
their
the shit out of each other,
right? Yeah, I mean, you know, and arguably, like, should have stayed, you know, should have kept with Britain, you know, whatever. But like, not to digress, but yeah, like, I mean, taking the world and making it seems so massive when you grow up in like a tiny town in America, and it keeps getting smaller and smaller. And you realize, like, people are just people, man. Like
everywhere, forever, you know? And always.
Yeah,
which I think is a sad but beautiful after it's sad thing, where you're like, oh wait, we're all human, this is a great experience that we share, and that's the reason why we love and work with each other.
Yeah,
great. So now we got to tell me about what's it like being our tour manager. You can, you know, this is obviously you can't ask
every
me.
Every day is a blessing. I wake up every day and I say God is good all the time, and all the time God is good. Honestly, it's great. I have worked for a few other bands. I enjoyed all my time with all of those bands. In my early days, I did merch for some old ska soul bands, or they were older than me at the time. And I mean, you're talking, I mean, those guys knew each other probably as long as y'all did, but you know, we're talking way more fist fights and like, you know, and just like people unhappy with each other from the get, before the shows even start happening on Warped Tour. You're like, we're already being violent with each other. So like, and you guys having grown up together, is the more we tour, the more bands you meet, realize that that is not the case and how special that is.
Totally.
Also being a tour manager. So the democracy of the Menzingers is one that I love to trumpet, but also disdain in the way that like, sometimes you're like, well, we couldn't reach a consensus, so nothing happened.
I'm with you on that one. I think it's one of our strongest and most beautiful assets that we have, one of the most beautiful aspects of our band. But it is a real democracy. Sometimes you just don't move.
It is a direct democracy, and there is no constituent. It's a constituency of one. You know, the
group. It's not a republicanism. This is this is straight up.
And everyone else who works for you feels the same way in terms of like feeling blessed that like the band, like, you know, there's bands, there's groups, there's artists where, and I see this from being a promoter and from touring, where like, yo, the lead singer, the guy who writes the songs, or the guitarist who writes the songs, it's all his decision. And whatever happens, you know, if they're a compassionate person and they're nice to their rhythm section or their guitarist or their DJ, cool. But if not, then everyone else is just, it's a paycheck, and what they say goes, and like that can create, you know, dictatorships can create, you know, a smooth tour for the crew and the tour manager, but also like that could be hell.
Amount of suffering.
Right. I've had to be the bad person who's like, especially in the van days with other bands that I worked for, I was like, well, look, this is happening because this member wants it. We're all in this van together having the same amount of terrible time, or not terrible, but just like, we're all grinding and suffering together for the greater good, but like this person makes our decisions, and I'm crew. So I already am not, don't really have a vote, you know? So having to keep the train moving, that like, that's your job as a tour manager, to like keep it going forward.
Good point. Totally. They keep it going forward no matter what. That's like the fucking job right there. I might use that as the little poll quote.
Yeah.
You've definitely shepherded and herded us in many situations. So there is the main thing that you do is make sure that you're the point of representation, the tip of the spear, if you will, of when we get to a venue to top down, organize, make sure everything runs. So when we're playing shows with, you know, 2,000 people or whatever, like that humble brag, that the entire thing, there's dozens of people who work for the venue. We have two dozen people on the actual tour, and they all need to work together for several hours to make sure everything happens smoothly and safely for thousands of people. And that's quite a haul. Like, have you noticed how that's changed since we were doing smaller shows? Do you now have to create a top-down culture that kind of permeates the entire thing? I've noticed that we try to keep within our group the same type of mentality that's front facing with the people that we interact with.
I mean, you got to be like, the comparison from the early days was, you know, we used to go in begging for things, right? Or stealing in some circumstances, you know,
circumstances,
right? It was a lot of back in the day, it was a lot of ask for forgiveness before permission.
Yeah,
just to keep things going and people fed, watered, and happy. And now it's about how do we create a bubble, whether it's backstage, you know, festival transportation, you know, the tour bus, the van, you know, the bands in the vans that are opening for you. How do we keep everyone happy and not just happy, like, oh, we're having a great time, but like wanting to give their all every night and keep playing. Yeah. Yeah, and that comes from, like, you know, from our sound tech, Dave March, you know, like making friends with the cranky old sound guy. Yeah, right?
Which the old sound guy is fucking cranky. I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, just like the crankiest. And like sometimes you just want to be like, hey, I bought you a nice hairbrush. Yeah. Because your hair is so old and long and you love Black Sabbath way too much. And I'm sorry we don't sound like Black Sabbath today, but it's just going to, you know, and like, but no, but Dave has a special, like, he has a special skill of like, because if you get the cranky audio and lighting people, on your side, then they're the ones who have to mix your opening bands, and then your opening bands are going to sound better, and they're also going to help you with the changeover. So, wow, cool, this show is running on time, right? So no one's going on later, no one's getting cut off, you know. And it's those little things, right? It's Nick Harris, their guitar tech, you know, helping the opening band get their gear off stage, so that like if a member's having you see someone's having a bad day, right? Or you know, the drummer's struggling with something, right? Or one member is completely clueless and can't help themselves. Like you've kept everyone, you know, now the like opening band and the direct support, like
there's always one.
Right, there's always, of course, there's always
one.
And
we've had our goes, each of us, in that and on those days in regards, but there's always one that has no it's kind of just rolling through the world. Yeah.
And I've kind of had this conversation, and like every time there's always some kid at Michigan State or someone that's like, how do you get into music? You know, and like, and understanding that it's like a very small world and you will see everyone again, mm-hmm. like you can't just like, you can cut no one off. Like the amount of times we've worked with a promoter in Phoenix or in Austin or Seattle. And, you know, if that would have went bad, then like we were going to go back there again, maybe at a larger venue, but it's probably going to be the same promoter because it's such a small industry. And, you know, it's, even in the early days, like the bar manager is probably also the promoter or whatever. And like treating people how you want to be treated and meeting them at least halfway, especially when it comes to like money and like, you know, the beer selection or whatever, or like times to load in, is where you'll have a smoother time. Touring, you know, and then even now when we're, you know, more often than not we're the headliner, but you know, we're still the opener or the direct support on bigger support tours. So
look, and we did the Vape Across America tour with the Offspring and Sublime,
right? We were the opener.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
which
those
was a blast.
Yeah, they were all like amphitheaters, and we just had to, like, you know, we had to beg to get, you know, the few things they were able to give us, but also, like, you know, making friends with their crew got us, you know, it got us better, you know, a better drum riser, right? You know,
totally. All those, absolutely.
Just those types of vibes. Cause like, you know, if you can suss out that most people like want the show to happen.
Yeah.
Right. At the end of the day, I mean,
you can't get to certain points without being able to work well with others, unless you have something extremely unique that everyone wants, you know, like, which I think is why some artists can get away with being the most outlandish or biggest assholes on the face of the earth to the people that work with and around them, which we don't do at all.
There's but no room punk.
Yeah, not to compare Offspring's crew to Flies, but you're going to attract more flies with honey than you do with, you know, something else. So that's being nice allows you to get the wheels greased for us to be able to do things. And I think that it's great answer to the question of how do we kind of create a top-down situation or vibe that rolls through the show. You know, I think that's great. And it's funny, we don't have that many enemies, but we have some people that we've not liked because of the way that they treated us. And it is funny in music how some of the inherent social hierarchies work. And what I mean by that is you have to be careful as well with who you're talking to. There's been so many instances where someone was extremely mean to one of us and then found out, you know, that we were in the Menzingers or that we worked with the Menzingers, and then they immediately changed their tone. We've had people come and knock on the door and apologize for things.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty fucking hilarious. And the takeaway there is like, why don't you just not be a dick? Then you don't have to worry about that. Safety issues, yeah, you should be a dick to someone if they're...
Right.
You should make them fear for their, like, their job if they're being unsafe, because a lot of what we do is not scripted safety-wise.
Precisely. I mean, like if say A Day to Remember goads the opening band's merch guy, who happens to be Scott Bell of the Menzingers, and says, "Hey, if we cover a Millen Collins song, will you stage dive off an arena stage over a barricade? Will you do that?" And then that guy, me, says, "Hell yeah," because you know, why? Because you're punk. And then when you put all those people in immediate peril, the tour manager for A Day to Remember, puts you in a headlock when you get backstage, and screams about you never being on a stage again. That was probably warranted to be put in a headlock.
That's by totally A Day to Remember. It was definitely warranted if he didn't know that they had put you up to it and all that. That's hilarious. That's the first time ever you mentioning it right now that I've ever thought of it, other than that guy being a huge dickhead. But now I'm right? Like, you know what? I totally get why that guy did that.
And I remember like Rise Against His Crew being like, "We get it, but like, think about the liability if you'd have broke somebody's neck, you idiot! Like was like a 10-foot jump. Why did you do? You know?" And you're like, "You know what? You're right. You've met Ian MacKay before, and I haven't yet." I trust your ethics on this. And then you know what? And then to A Day to Remember's to their credit, they yelled at their old TM, and he brought you guys a case of beer to apologize.
He did. He knocked on the door. He came in. He put the beer down. He grunted and he left.
Yeah.
Which now I feel even more weird about, because I'm like, damn, he was just doing his job, and then they made him grovel or whatever you'd want to call it.
And then I'm thinking, did that extra amount of beer that made its way into the van that got snuck into the next venue, did that contribute to a member of the Menzingers being too inebriated and trying to sell their own merch in a stadium, in the next arena, which is a big no-no in the big world, it amounted to that member waltzing into the counting room where there's just piles of money being made by two very big bands and demanding.
Yeah, I was in the room, but it was me. I was in the room earlier. There's piles of cash.
No, this was, yeah.
Piles of cash in these rooms.
This is not a future. Yeah, because I think you were the first, because I didn't see it firsthand. And I believe they were selling the other, the headliners, Rise Against and A Day to Remember's merchandise, so fast and furious that our t-shirts had been thrown on the ground.
Yeah, there's, that happened a lot. So basically, someone else, they'll have in-house people handle the merch and cash. To make sure that, you know, for whatever reason, create jobs, they know the space, they know what's going on, taxes, they make sure that they click accountability for the accounting. But we're a small, at the time, we're a very small band, and we needed to sell merch to be able to keep moving. And they would sell our merch for us, but since we wouldn't hardly sell anything, they would just sell the other band's merch, and our shit was literally just lying on the floor.
It was in South Carolina.
Yeah, and the guy who was in charge of it all was an off-duty sheriff.
That was his like side gig, was like running the merchandising, the in-house merchandising outfit for that like large theater.
Yeah.
And then and that was the second time we got yelled at on that tour, to like stop ruining everything, because people have to,
They're working.
They're actually, these are actual jobs. Being punk rock is not a job yet for you guys. Stop ruining everything.
Yeah, we would climb up to the third, because in the arenas, one of my favorite things we did was throw the paper airplane from the top of the sports arena down to the front. Or the Frisbee. We threw a Frisbee from the top all the way down. And we would just go to the press boxes and just openly smoke weed in them. That was one part of the royalty of that tour, which was hilarious, is if you had that pass, you really could do whatever you wanted. Because they just, all of the people working the show, the hundreds of security, were just like, oh my God, there's the... what do they know less than I'm like the guitar player for Bruce Springsteen situation, who would normally play there?
It's above your pay grade, right? For those who have been in those situations, because Corey Cerisi was on that tour, and he'd get weed, and then you'd be like, "I found a spot," and then it would just be like, the press box.
Yeah, the press box of the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yeah, right. And then you're hotboxing this, and they'd be like, "What are you doing in here?" I'm like, "Oh, we matter." And then he'd be like, "Are you sure?" And he'd be like, "Yep."
And be like, "Oh, sorry." That shit was so fucking funny. So you said something to me one time while I was on stage packing up cables. And it was about, so I'd mentioned something about social anxiety. And you looked at me and you said something very simple and very akin to like, "I don't know. I don't have that." I've never had it. And you were very matter of fact and you fucking walked away. And I was like, damn, that was hard as hell. First off, it was hard. It was also in a situation where people, there was something going on where tensions were really high. Right. And you were just like, I don't know. I don't have to deal with that. Boom, walked off. And I wondered, that's such a great part of you. You were always the guy who was willing to do something hilarious to bring the morale of everybody up. And also goes back to the fact that you could just dress up as a serial character, that you were in a Cartridge Family. And yeah, so I think that makes you an incredibly personable human being, a great tour manager to be able to deal with in-house people. And this last year, you spun it into political organization. I wouldn't even call it activism necessarily because of all the connotations that go along with that, but yeah. It's actually activism.
Yeah.
Yeah, organizing. So that experience, watching you be able to carry that out this last year was incredible. What did you take away from that? Or why don't you just give us a little rundown of what you were doing?
Of like the organizing and stuff?
Yeah, of organizing voters.
I remember thinking when we're on tour in January, it's like, oh no, what if I'm not able to volunteer for the election? And like, what if I'm not able to do my part? You know, the first like election I ever volunteered for, I was a precinct captain for John Kerry in 2004. I was 18. But this time, with the pandemic, provided me plenty of time. And especially in post Trump, you know, I started an Indivisible chapter, which was, you know, bringing people together who had no interest in politics before and teaching them like how, you know, the rules for radicals, you know, the difference between activism and organizing, right? Activism is just shouting to a certain degree, which is necessary. But organizing is how do we collectively think about this subject, this object, and then put it, how do we make the machine move for us to get this accomplished, right?
Exactly. Especially in a year where everyone was forced to be on social media and kind of a lot of yelling at each other, yelling the same things, and kind of like, not to be so cynical about it, but I mean, to be frank, I am very cynical about it. The slacktivism armchair kind of shit where screaming into the void of the people who are screaming the same thing doesn't move.
Yeah.
And you actually, you know, learned how and manifested that movement.
Yeah. I mean, we had that group and that, obviously that was volunteer, but you know, we petitioned and you know, organized phone banking and all the simple like
campaigns and stuff for the Koch brothers.
Yes, this is for the shadowy super PACs, which led me to a real job with a political action committee called Progressive Turnout Project, which was solely focused on my area that I'm very passionate about, which is like deep canvassing, which like Bernie, I'm paraphrasing, but like Bernie Sanders kind of invented the like, go back to this door, go to where the people are, right? Stop trying to raise $1 million on Twitter for, you know,
that you spend on a psychologist to change your ads, you know,
like, exactly, you know, right, to run a bunch of ads in Maine to unseat Susan Collins, who's going to win anyway because you carpet bagged her state with ads. Great job, you know.
Yeah.
Go to where, and if that requires, I remember telling my directors, because like, I mean, I'm 34. A lot of the kids in our group, I found out, were like very early 20 somethings, you know, and had just found politics. Was like telling them, like, you know, I'm from here. There's not a neighborhood in this city that you could put me in that I wouldn't feel comfortable speaking to any race, creed, religion, whatever person. Sure. Like, no matter, like, it, like, put me in a house, like the houses where there's shit everywhere in the lawn and there's two cars that don't work, and like I will knock on that door and I can speak like through them to them, like, and also most importantly, just listen to people.
Yeah.
You know, just listen. The amount of times that people say like, oh, no one ever come down here before, you know. So much of organizing is going to the, you know, canvassing those apartment complexes where every 30 seconds a smoke detector beeps because people can't afford the 9-volt to change it. Right. Yeah. And so you have this like, and you're like, that's the kind of social justice that I'm really passionate about and led me to work for Progressive Turnout Project in the election. And it was super fulfilling. And, you know, we did great. We had some great numbers in terms of like door knock numbers and phone banking. You know, the pandemic kind of threw out the playbook.
Yeah. Yeah, so you guys put up some incredible numbers with the phone banking and going door to door, and you did go to apartment complexes where you saw, you know, the smoke detectors going off because people couldn't afford to do it. And you said this is an extremely, you know, fulfilling job. Back to that contextualization that you've all had with kind of seeing the regional differences in the United States and where things came from Europe, I can't think of a more clear education on the state of people and their thoughts and feelings and conditions than actually going and talking to them. So I think that you can get the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia to do as many surveys as you can imagine with parameters to try to gauge the, for lack of a better word, poll them on something or try to gauge the way that people behave certain ways. But you physically going and actually meeting and seeing people and then subconsciously internalizing their body language and all of those kinds of things has to be such an enormous wealth of knowledge. Like, you have to have an understanding of people and the voter that is beyond what you could possibly have virtually, for lack of a better word. And I feel like that that reversion or that stepping, not even reversion, that stepping back to that type of canvassing and political outreach has got to be huge now. And you must know so much about that. So what do you do with this knowledge?
When those people don't take polls, right? Go to where the people are and like go to winnable, gettable voters. Like, the whole process was people who voted Democrat or left at some point, maybe skipped an election, maybe they're too young, right, to have voted enough, and then petition to them, stop screaming at, you know, the other side of the aisle that's actually, that you're probably not going to convince them anyway. Like, we don't want to talk to them. We want to talk to the massive middle who is apathetic, thinks it doesn't matter, and thinks their opinion doesn't matter because no one's either asked them, or if they have been asked, they haven't bothered to think about it, you know, and approach people with that like power in hand. Like, the amount of times on the phone I would just be like, that's your power to change that. Like, that's what this voting is like voting is part of that, you know? And like, then you break it down like past like the fucking president, man, like, you know, all the way down to the local issues, you know, every state, and like, that's how you get people to like about face away from apathy, which is the worst part, right? Because that's how they win, when we constantly shout like they're all the same, nothing can change, right? Because and that's the I also feel that's the constant progressive, the problem with progressive politics is once you have success and you move the chains and you've moved the goalposts further as well. So like, yesterday, tomorrow's hope and change is now today's, well, that's just the way it is, right? We've always had this, you know, but you're like, oh, wait a minute. Like, and then you quickly remember like, oh, like you watch an Office, a season, episodes, you know, from The Office in the first two seasons, and they make a joke about gays not being able to legally marry. And you're like, oh yeah, that was like a fact of our lives that like they couldn't.
That was a fact of our lives with some of our currently celebrated politicians stood on the wrong side of only like 5 or 6 years ago. It's insane how quickly it has changed and how powerful we actually become.
If you actually push them to like, it's like Biden talks about like, you know, the Green New Deal and like Sunrise Movement stuff, which one of the co-founders is from Lansing. And you're like, he's like, it's on you guys to like push me. So like, get into that good trouble and like actually take that to the people and like show me these polls that like we can do this and like, and push me. Right. So like that's, and realizing that like, they're just a tool, right? This is like, most of these politicians are not like bad or good, like guardians or angels of like,
I think that's a huge point. There's two points that you made up. I want to save that one. I'm just going to make a little note here, the politician as a tool, and jump back to the idea of empowering the people that you spoke with and listened to. So it seems like a lot of the obnoxious and horrible screaming into the void that then breeds apathy is people trying to get power. I think even a facet of using very stringent political rules to try and destroy people's careers is like the furthest manifestation of that need for power, like cancel culture shit. And what, you know, actually bringing the power to people, what is that like? Like, that's actually what you're doing. And that is actually the end goal. It isn't necessarily to just get people to vote for your candidate. You're going out there and showing people that they can vote. And when they do vote, that it is actual movement and not just like an abstract notion in their brain from a screen.
And especially if they like have like an issue they care about too, right? Like, seeing movement on that. You know, like we have a work group that's like dedicated to changing laws on how you, when you arrest like a 17-year-old, trying them in as adults, right? And changing that law, right? And they've been like pounding the pavement there. And when they started, so many people were like, I could never call my representative. Like, what do you mean? And now like they know the people who work in their office by name.
Yeah.
And they're just like
huge.
And pandemic wise, like I've been on unemployment. So walking through people that process, and explaining to them, like, and you know, you see people post on Facebook and I'm like, call your state rep now. Like it's a state run system and like they work for you. Make them give you all the information that you, like, clearly you filled out something wrong. You know, it's an archaic, shitty system, and like make those people do, like, not do it for you, but like make them give you the tools or like the information to do it properly. So that, like, you get the things you're entitled to, right? Your entitlements, right? So you get your unemployment that you and your employer paid into. It's simple as that, you know, just been like, these are not stratified, untouchable people and organizations. Like, they're exactly
what we're led to think. You know, maybe we're not even led to think that. Maybe the system just became that way, and that's what we think from that generated apathy. Which, if you look at it, a lot of the GOP campaigns where they have spent enormous amounts of money is just straight up disenfranchisement. That's not a strategy that I've seen on a nationwide scale from, you know, the Democrats or any other party. They're straight up just trying to stop people from voting. It's like, that's the idea, is we don't necessarily need to convince you to vote for a candidate. We just need you to not vote so that you don't vote for a candidate that you would typically vote for. So back to the politician as a tool. We spent so much in the United States, and maybe it's because of the way that we've told stories since the beginning of stories, since we've been standing around campfires, but a lot of our political theater is based around the personality and behavior of the politician themselves, which obviously is a huge factor. But look at any let's say we'll break it down and use campaign ads as an example. You look at some of the campaign ads that were being run in Georgia in the runoff election, or the last time I watched TV at my brother's house, I was visiting and we were watching some local TV, and the ads were insane, and they appealed to deep emotional biases. They appealed to ideas of like safety, and none of them talked about anything actual. So as politician, as a tool, how can we get people to realize that that's what they are? They kind of, in theory, have to vote the way that you want them to vote.
Yeah. I mean, in like, especially when you get down to the, like, the week before the election, the 2 weeks before the election, like, it's you stop having those conversations with again, like, winnable and gettable voters.
Yeah.
And so then it does become like there's all those undecided people who are really, we like Progressive Turnout Project, that like tries to reach before, you know, so you can withstand that onslaught of like, be afraid of your dark neighbor, right? Be afraid of the your neighbors who just moved in who speak Spanish, you know?
Yeah.
Like, or it's simple as that, right? Or like,
totally. Or your young neighbor, like, even be any of that. Anyone who's going to make you unsafe in some way.
Or take your job, or like make it so your kids, you know, if you've got to build people up with like the positive narratives of like change and like, or that they deserve a $15 wage and they deserve healthcare and like, you know,
totally.
You know, I mean, I remember speaking to this one woman who was like, getting her to register to vote was a struggle. And I was like, well, you go here. And she's like, the courthouse. She goes like, oh yeah, I've been there. Like, I'm in a domestic dispute with my ex, and like, oh, I know exactly. That. And like, so like walking her through that process and then empowering her that like, oh yeah, like, no, like, you deserve healthcare. Your kid deserves this healthcare. Like, it's not like they don't, you know, your private employer doesn't bestow it upon you. You don't, you know, you don't earn it by being a good citizen. You know, you just deserve it by a right. And like,
totally,
this is who you vote for, right? If you want that, you know, and also they don't want you to have that, you know.
Totally. And I gotta say that before this last year, maybe the year before that or whatever, at this point in my life, I thought of that kind of as almost a custodianship mindset. The idea was like, you have to go to people who don't have the the money, the you know, whatever background, institutional racism was not a problem for us. We were able to understand these concepts. So you don't want to turn it into a custodianship of like patronizing people and being like, I think there's a fine line is what I'm trying to say. So that you would be like, yeah, you deserve this, you need this, as to being like, well, I know better for you. And I think that that's a tough one to dance sometimes. And it's also one that I find to be extremely like frustrating about the Democrats. But
Totally. And there's, especially in like coming and being in massive metropolises and like big machines that can like, where like your city has larger budgets than some states, even, you know, not like
a bunch of countries in the fucking EU, you know?
Like. Yeah. And like, so that those types of machines and like, I see those battles as like, you know, what I tell Dave, I was like, I'm just trying to get America to like England level shitty, right? Like until we get like, until everyone can just have health insurance and it's not a game of like chasing all, you know, like, then like you solve that and like then you can start to like, I don't know, education around like, you know, universal income and all these types of like notions that seem so far-fetched, but if we can just get people to stop worrying about like dying right daily,
eating for a lot of people, or where you're gonna live, it's fucking insane. So that very satisfying political talk with you, Scott. Thank you. I missed us. I feel like we can breach on the point of me and you talking on the phone again.
Yes.
The political shit. So I wanted to ask you this one now, maybe towards the end here. At this age, and maybe you don't feel the same way as me, now that I'm 34 years old, I've been doing this music thing for a very long time. I've gotten very good at it. You've gotten very good at what you do. At what point does it become a situation where we do not become custodians or patronize people, but become mentors or kind of teach people what's going on? Do you have a plan for like your next step of employing people or of how you're going to work with kids? Or like you mentioned, you were the de facto kind of shepherd of the kids who were doing the job that were much younger than you, had just discovered politics. Like, where do you see that becoming a facet of your life?
Yeah. I mean, just in terms of like music and stuff too, like trying to create, I mean, just keeping that dive bar, those, and those venues like open to new artists and new promoters and new kids that like, and if that's, and not just rock music, right? Not just booking the shit I like, you know? And, but like if there's just more hip hop artists and there's more EDM artists right now than there are kids that picked up a guitar, like, so be it.
Yeah, that's
like
life.
Like facilitate them understanding how to promote a show and how to make people show up and how to like be on time and pack their gear down properly. You know, the amount of times, you know, the simple things of like jumping on stage when you see that kid drummer undoing his cymbals on stage and being like, and just picking up the whole cymbal and being like, no. We pack that up off stage. There's no time for this. You have 10 minutes to get off the stage. And I'm like, what? And you're like, yeah, dude, like, think about it this way. Like, oh, I'm 19. I've never thought about other people in that way. And me inconvenience myself.
I don't have the frontal cortex to
right. But yeah, I mean, keeping that sustainable, because we've been to those towns, right? And where you're like, oh, scene used to be good for this type of music and now it's gone because people didn't invest time or effort into like keeping it around and keeping the venues going and stuff. I mean,
yeah. Fucking A.
That's like, and then and then to move on like politically too, like pulling every lever you can, you know? If it's talking to friends and family, then that's your deal. If it's like writing 1,000 letters, right? Like if it's phone banking and door knocking, like as much time as you can give is going to have to be enough. I mean, especially from the last 4 years, you know?
Yeah.
That was the like 5-alarm fire where you're like, we won't have, like, if you think, if we lose this time, if Donald Trump wins again, if you think there will be a like transparent democracy to like to try to win again with, that
chances
is false.
Good.
That is that will not happen. Like if to like to get to where we to get to where I want Bernie Sanders to be president, or like, you know, Fetterman or Sherrod Brown or whatever, like working class, like pro-labor candidate into the White House or whatever, like, that's not even a going to be an option, right? You can't, like, unless...
Yeah, that won't be... They'll have to be disguised as something else there.
Right. It's got to move sometimes incrementally, you know?
Exactly.
Because the other option is bloody revolution, and, like...
If we don't want that.
And you, like, yeah, as much as Twitter would like you to think otherwise, like... You don't want food insecurity for your family.
I'm so glad that you brought up food insecurity, because it seems to be, of all the things that, you know, we have our separate history memes chat, which I love, which sometimes we dive into the real shit. But one of the things that seems to be, and I could be corrected by an actual historian, seems to be the case of the violence when it's in the streets. We had looting and burning in June, and we had people storm the Capitol, but when things become very bad is when you have food insecurity. And I think the last thing that we want is the type of violence that will bring about that economic disruption to where a truck full of corn doesn't make it from Kansas to Harrisburg.
Yeah, he doesn't want to. It's not worth the wage to drive it, or it's not worth his life to make the system that puts the food in your grocery store, right?
Totally.
And the pandemic almost did that. Right.
Exactly.
The pandemic almost did that.
They talked about it. I mean, there was a run. Fuck. So what I really hope people take away from this is the one thing that I've learned over and over again with historical journeys with you on tour and with everybody is that people can make a huge difference. I went in my thinking swinging back and forth between, well, no, it's systems. And there's always a nuanced reason for these historical events that we learn about, from whether it's Rosa Parks, you know, who had a predecessor that was... You find out she's an engineered kind of way to do it, which is, you know, amazing. It doesn't take away from her heroism anyway. But I'm saying, because there's more nuance there, as there are a lot of situations where there's just one person. And now I think that, no, there really is. There is your Rosa Parks. There really are one person that can make enormous differences. And you can also make subtle differences, like you have, immensely. And I hope that people are able to take that away and do their own scene, book their own EDM shows if that's what they want, book their own open mic nights. Open mic nights. Wow. That's a new one. Open mic nights.
I'd buy it. I mean, yeah, putting yourself in a position where luck can find you, and that, whether that's like a job, right? Like,
damn, that's good. Put yourself, like, increase your ability to attract luck.
And, like, I mean, you know, and not being an asshole. So people want to be around you so that they say, like, oh, like, let's take him in the van, right? We'll share our Taco Bell money with him, and he can drive the van and do the merch. And, like, you know, if that's how you got to get out of your Midwest town, then, like, that's how you did it, right? And, like, and then politically, like, set your organization up in a way to, like, whether that's through, like, League of Women Voters or, you know, Planned Parenthood Action Fund, like, to move the levers when the time is right for you to do them, right? And then to be set up for when real protest happens, right? When, like, George Floyd is murdered, that there's already a movement there that can, like, pick up that steam. And that's, like you said, like Rosa Parks, like, the whole civil rights movement was, like, lots of infrastructure and, like...
Yeah. And that's why it worked.
That's why it worked, right?
It worked as well as it did. Amazing. So let me ask you, if someone wants to get in touch with you, how can they? Or what do you got? Where can they reach you or see what's going on if they're in Michigan, or if they have questions for you, how to start their own situations?
Yeah, so... Pretty much all my socials are Scotty Bell, SKOTTY Bell, and that's my email as well. So if anybody had, like, questions about how to mess with the system,
how to completely shift an election,
yes, how to propose to your district leaders in New York that they should pay you instead of phone banking to let you message all of your Juggalo rapper friends on Facebook how to vote for an entire week, and be like, look, I can reach all of these people. Like, they're good salt of the earth friends of mine. They love smoking weed, and I know that if someone actually bothers to speak to them, they'll vote.
Love it so much.
Give me the time, right?
Dude, thank you so much for coming on. I'm hoping to have regular guests that come on frequently, and I hope that you would want to be one of those guests. You can come on and talk about specific things that are happening, especially maybe we'll do a little current events. We had some really fun chats about the GameStop debacle and about different foreign policy things that happen. So I'd really appreciate that.
Could I be one of those guys who, like, calls into, like, the AM radio or, like, the like morning radio, who kind of has a weird voice, and then you, like, hang up on, like, religiously?
Oh, like, yeah, for sure.
I want to be one of, or like how David Letterman treated Regis Philbin like garbage all the time, which is like, like, you know, I want that. I want the podcast version of that.
Yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to, next time I have somebody on where we need your opinion, we'll pause the podcast. I'm going to call you and then we'll get it on and I'm just going to get it, going to hang it up. Perfect. That'd be great. But yeah, dude, thank you so much for coming. I hope you have a incredible weekend. It is Friday. Until next time.
Yeah, so great to hear from you. Take care, buddy.
Bye-bye. And there you have it. What I hope is the first of many conversations with the legendary Scott Bell. Once again, thank you to Beth Ann Downey for producing this thing. Thanks to Queen Jesus for the intro song. You have an idea? You fancy yourself a fancy thinker? Well, email me, tom@futurefriday.net. That is tom@futurefriday.net. Until next time, so long.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street Podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.